Father, we're grateful today for the time together. We're thankful for the season, the remembrance of the incarnation. We're thankful for this opportunity to look at history and to look at a country and look at some events that had impact even in our present day. And help us to evaluate these things rightly and to learn the lessons of history. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. What country on the continent had Scotland traditionally looked to for support in its fights against England?
France.
France, that's right. What was the name given to those who supported this traditional policy? Anybody remember? Remember the Greek word for love is philos? Talk about France. Francophiles. And what was the name given to those who favored looking to England for support? Because there was a bit of a back and forth going on there. Same Greek word, only instead of Frank,
Anglophiles.
That's right. We got Francophiles and Anglophiles. Those that wanted to go with France, and those were like, no, England's a good place to go. What great reformer had the relationship to Scotland that Luther had to Germany and Calvin had to Geneva?
John Knox.
What eventually happened to John Knox after he joined a group of Protestants holed up in St. Andrew's Cathedral?
He was taken captive.
Yes, he was taken captive by the French. They made him into a galley slave. He eventually was released and served as a pastor, first in England until Bloody Mary came on the scene. Then he decided he was getting out of Dodge. And then he went to Geneva and worked with the Scottish congregation, refugee congregation there, along with Calvin in Geneva. Well, he was there, and he said it was one of the happiest places he'd been in his life, was Geneva. He loved his time there. Ironic, because John Calvin hated being in Geneva, and yet he was the one who made it what it was. But at any rate, he didn't get to stay there any more than John Calvin. Remember, John Calvin's favorite spot was Strasbourg. That was where he wanted to spend the rest of his life. But we don't always get to spend the rest of our life where we want to spend it. Sometimes God has other plans. And God had other plans for John Knox. He wanted John Knox to return to Scotland. So John Knox did return to Scotland in 1559 at the urgent request of his Protestant leaders. They needed his leadership. They missed his preaching. He was a fiery preacher. But what I understand, the descriptions, and I don't give it in our outline points, but I'll just mention it to you. They said he would go through a passage almost, you know, exegetically, scholarly, looking at all the details of, because, you know, he was trained in the languages and so forth. And then when he got done exegeting everything, then he launched into a fiery sermon about how this applies today. It's like he shifted gears. And he was very much engaged with the events of the day, and he very much saw application of theology to the modern, his modern time, his day. But a lot had happened in his native land since his departure for the French galleys. Remember, he was taken captive by the French, and he served some time as a slave. And then he went to, as we said, he went to England, and he went to Geneva. And now he's called back to Scotland. It's been, you know, about 12 years. So some things have happened. For one thing, Mary of Guise, the widow of James V, and she was the mother of the then 12-year-old Queen Mary Stuart, also known as Mary Queen of Scots. Mary of Guise had assumed regency. She'd taken the reins, so to speak, of things in Scotland in 1554 after her husband had died. And at first, remember, she was French, and at first she was tolerant of the Protestants because she wanted to win them over to her anti-English, pro-French policy. So she recognized she couldn't just come in and start, you know, throwing her weight around. She was Catholic, she was French, but she recognized that the dominant force in Scotland at this time was Scottish, though there were Catholics around. But there was growing resentment among many Scots at the way Scotland seemed to be becoming a mere French province. They felt like this Francophile thing was being pushed way too hard. And especially after young Mary Stuart, Mary Queen of Scots, was married to Prince Francis of France, the heir to the French throne, in April of 1558. You remember Henry VIII had made a move on her and offered his son Edward as the husband, and they said, no, we want her to go back to France, we want her to be trained in the French ways, and we want her to be a proper French lady. So they sent her to France and got her away from Scotland for the time being. She comes back on the scene here, as we're going to see. This fear of French domination was especially strong among the Scottish Protestants, and you can imagine why, because the government of France was militantly Roman Catholic. Was then, still is to this day. France has, it had an attempted reformation, the French Huguenots, you know, and Calvin was from France and so forth, and it wasn't like there was a total lack of Protestant pool in France, but Protestantism never really gained a foothold in France the way it did in Scotland, in England, and in other countries. And so the influence of France is in a sense an influence of Catholicism, and the Protestants are a little uneasy about that, as you might understand. So it was within this religious and political context that the Protestant members of the Scottish nobility became increasingly determined to secure a Protestant government for their country. So on December 3rd, 1557, the leaders of the Protestant nobility banded together by signing a covenant in which they pledged themselves to renounce Roman Catholicism as the Congregation of Satan.
Yeah.
They got off the fence. No, they were clear. And to promote their freedom to preach and practice according to their Protestant beliefs. They were following in the theological thinking of many in their day, especially John Knox was a leader in this line of thought, which is that we have a right to form our own church. We don't have to wait on the government. And if the person at the top of the chain of command isn't doing what they ought to do, we have the ability to use the lower authorities, the local lords, to whip them into line, as it were, and pull them down from power if need be. But one way or another, they were very big on, they didn't have an idea of, you know, well, we keep our religion over here in one box and our politics over here in another box. They put the two together. And these Protestant nobles called themselves the Lords of the Congregation of Jesus Christ. So they were lords, but of the Congregation of Jesus Christ. They were standing up for their Protestant rights and beliefs. And honestly, at first, things did not go well for the Scottish Protestants. Mary of Guise requested troops from France in order to crush the lords of the congregation. She's like, okay, enough of these guys. We're going to bring in the Catholic troops from France. I've got connections in France, and we're going to teach these guys a lesson. They are not in charge. I'm in charge. And, you know, the Protestants did achieve some victories over the invader, but their army was lacking in material resources and could not maintain in the field for long. They weren't going to stand up very well against the French army. And for a time, the military situation hung doubtfully and dangerously in balance. Only John Knox's phenomenal preaching kept alive the courage and constancy of the Scottish Protestant army. So here you have a preacher, John Knox, who is encouraging the military and what it's doing, what they're standing for. interesting. And of course, again, this is very consistent with what John Knox has written about. We saw this last week. This was his theology. He believed in these two things going together, that you stand up for your religious beliefs and you fight for them if necessary. And so he would continue to come in and preach his fiery sermons and say, we're doing the right thing. You know, we're standing up for what's right. Keep your courage. Don't give up. Don't be afraid. The Protestant army sent repeated appeals to England, arguing if the Catholics were able to crush the Protestant rebellion in Scotland, and that kingdom was thus in the hands of Catholic faction and closely tied to France, Elizabeth's crown would be endangered. And this is a good argument, right? I mean, think about it. You know, this is Scotland is up here on the northern tip of the English Isle. And if the French and the Catholics get a foothold up here, how long does Elizabeth think she's going to be safe with her Protestant government down here in the south? That she's going to eventually have to fight that battle. This almost reminds me, I remember seeing the movie, what was it called, about Churchill we saw recently, where, you know, Churchill was on the phone to Franklin Roosevelt saying, hey, you know, they're coming for us, but we need your help now because they'll be after you next, kind of thing. You know, I mean, these kinds of things happen in history sometimes. You've got the bigger power out here in the background and the guys who are on the front lines are getting crushed and they're saying, come help us now while you can. We're here to help you because eventually they're coming for you. Kind of a similar idea, I think. So they're going, Elizabeth, please, send troops, help. Finally, in early 1560, Elizabeth decided to send troops to Scotland. So she finally saw the logic and decided to go with it. The English army joined the Scottish Protestants in a long war seemed inevitable. But then, in the providence of God, Mary of Guise died. And the French decided it was time to sue for peace. Well, that changed everything. Okay, so a providential move on the part of God, this queen who's, you know, pushing for Catholic dominance is dead, and she's the one that called in the French army, and they're kind of like, okay. As a result, July 6, 1560, the Treaty of Edinburgh between England and France brought about the withdrawal of both French and English troops from Scotland. So the war was over, the troops all went home, Scotland had their independence, and Protestantism was victorious. The immediate aftermath of the Treaty of Edinburgh was something called the Reformation Parliament of July and August of 1560. So they didn't lose any time. They had the military and the national political situation wrapped up. Now they wanted to go ahead and get in place some legal support for Reformed theology within the nation itself. In terms of Scotland's religious history and cultural identity, this was the most important parliament in the country's history, according to the history book I'm quoting from, which is a pretty strong statement. The parliament approved a new Reformed confession of faith for the national church. Now, they still have a national church, but it's a Protestant national church, and it's in Scotland. It's a Scottish Protestant national church. This was the Scots confession. It was drawn up by John Knox. Well, you know he would be involved. And five other leading Reformed men. They were John Wilcox, John Winram, John Spottiswood, John Rowe, and John Douglas. There were six Johns involved in this. I guess John was a popular name then. I don't know. John and Mary seem to be all over the place here. So the six Johns put together a Scottish confession. It was clearly a Reformed confession. The new Protestant Church of England was to be Reformed. It was not to be Lutheran. And was definitely not to be Catholic. The Parliament outlawed the Roman Catholic Mass with penalties for its celebration. No Roman Catholics, no Roman Catholic Masses, out. They acknowledged the Reformed preachers as alone competent to administer the sacraments and abolished all papal jurisdiction over Scotland. So this was a political sealing of the Protestant dominance in Scotland. The other great Scottish Reformation, document of the Scottish Reformation, was called the First Book of Discipline and was a comprehensive blueprint for a Protestant society. And John Knox had his fingers all over this one. It outlined a Presbyterian form of church polity, which included the popular election of ministers by congregations, elders who would assist ministers in the exercise of moral discipline. Notice again that bifurcation that the unbiblical bifurcation that was introduced into early church history, and here it is still there, ministers and elders, and deacons who were to take charge of the finances of the church. So other than that, actually this layout is not very different from you know, a Presbyterian church today, right? The first book of discipline also set out a program, this is interesting, of relief for the poor on a scale unknown in Western Europe until the coming of the welfare state. So there was a provision there for the church to take care of the poor. There was also a massive educational program that was likewise drafted. Every parish was to have a school as well as a church, and all this was to be financed by the wealth of the old church, the old Catholic Church. Remember, this is reminiscent of what we saw in England. Remember when they took over the monasteries? I believe it was under Edward. And they just decided to confiscate all the wealth from the Catholic Church. Remember, the Catholic Church, between the monasteries and the various other assets that they had in place, they had greater wealth than the nation itself. Remember that? We saw that in England. By far, like by multiple times more wealth. There was a tremendous amount of wealth here. So when the Protestants come in, they're taking over. Catholics are now illegal. And they're just taking over all their stuff, all their property. And John Knox says, I want to use all these assets that are being used for Catholicism, and I want to put it over into the treasury of the Scottish Church, and I want to provide for the poor with it, and I want to provide for education so that the young people can be brought up in Scottish Protestant thinking. And that was his dream, but it never ended up happening. Why is that? Well, the democratic tone of the first book of discipline made the nobility uneasy, and most of them preferred to seize the old church assets for themselves rather than for Knox's utopian program. So they're like, nah, it's all right. We'll take that. And of course, they were providing a lot of the military strength, and they had some say in the matter. And Knox didn't get his. Knox was very disappointed in that decision. So there's, and I'm sure he continued to fight. So the nobles decided to bring in another wild card. This is where it really gets interesting. Mary, Queen of Scots, returns to Scotland. Remember, she was sent by her mom, Mary Guise, to France to be trained up as a French lady. And right about this time, she's probably about 18 years old. So she's old enough to begin functioning as an adult ruler. And so in the midst of all these struggles between Knox and the Lords trying to figure out how things are going to get all, how they're all going to settle out now that the Protestants are in charge, the nobles decide to invite Mary Stuart, Mary's Queen of Scots, to return to Scotland and claim the throne that she had inherited from her father, James V. So she had royal lineage that traces back through James V, James IV, and we had shown that family tree. I'll show it to you again in a minute. And she has some rights to be a ruler there. Of course, the only problem is she's French and she's Catholic. But the nobles decide to invite her back. This was a mysterious move for me. They must have been desperate in their fight against John Knox. That's all I can think. I don't know. Mary had hoped, actually, to remain in France as queen of that country. She really didn't ever want to come back to Scotland. She considered herself French. Ever since she'd been very young, she'd been raised there. And she married a Frenchman who was a ruler in France, and she expected to be a queen in France, but then her husband died and deprived her of that honor, and therefore she agreed to the Scottish request. She said, well, I can't be a queen here. I'll go back to Scotland where they're inviting me to be queen. At least I can be a queen. And she wasn't willing to just settle for Scotland either, as you'll see. She arrives in Scotland in 1561, and although she'd never been popular, at first she was content to follow the advice of her illegitimate half-brother, James Stuart, whom she herself actually named Earl of Moray, a Protestant leader who prevented her from immediately alienating the other Protestant lords. So she comes back to Scotland. She's an outsider. She's a foreigner. She's Catholic in a Protestant country that just outlawed Catholicism. She knows she has to be careful and tread lightly. She's never been very popular. Who's she going to bounce off of back in Scotland? Well, she finds James Stuart, who it says is her illegitimate half-brother. Her dad was known to be unfaithful to his wife. He had many illegitimate children. This was one of them. In fact, I think he was the child of one of his favorite mistresses, as it turns out. And he's a Protestant. And he's very connected to the Protestant leaders in Scotland. So she decides, hey, he's my brother, even though he's a half-brother, an illegitimate brother. I can bounce off of him. He's somebody I'm connected to relationally. And he can give me advice as to how to handle things, because she needed some help. Mary was young, beautiful, charming, spirited, highly intelligent, well-educated in the learning of the French Renaissance. So she was a very attractive young lady, very gifted, and these qualities won her widespread popularity, and few men, even devout Protestant men, could resist her attractions. You know the type, right? With the notable exception, of course, of John Knox, who viewed her simply and exclusively as the enemy of the Reformation. And I just found out recently they made a movie in 2018, Mary, Queen of Scots. Has anybody seen it? I didn't know it was made. I don't even know how I stumbled across it. I was looking up something, and I think I came across it. I'm always looking for pictures of people, how to portray them, like that picture I showed of her. Obviously, that's more photographic. That's from the movie. So I went ahead and watched the movie. I do not recommend it unless you're willing to close your eyes and fast forward a lot, because they have inserted a lot of modern perverted garbage, I don't know the way to say it, into the movie. Otherwise, it's a very good history movie, and it's very interesting and all that, but it's just there's portions of it you're like, Oh, they've managed to find homosexuality and transgenderism and everything else in this era, which wasn't there, I'm sad to say. But anyhow, they did a good job of portraying her personality and her arrogance. From the time of her arrival, Mary insisted on having Mass celebrated in her private chapel. So she never gave up her Catholicism. And she says, fine, they're Protestants. I'm going to have my own little Mass in my own chamber. Thank you very much. And the fiery reformer John Knox began preaching against the idolatry of the new Jezebel. And her and John Knox had some conversations, and boy, they did not go well. And John Knox just told her where the cow ate the cabbage, told her she was an idolater and she was a new Jezebel, and he didn't hold back anything. He let loose completely on her, and she was infuriated. How dare you talk to me that way? In fact, at one point she had him arrested for treason, but he got off and she's like, nope. she couldn't put him down. She couldn't stop him. But in the end, Mary Stuart really caused her own downfall. It wasn't John Knox. He didn't care for her at all. He had no use for her. But she ruined her own deal. She had always dreamed of sitting on the throne of England. Scotland was not enough for her. And in pursuit of that dream, she lost her own throne and her life. It was her cousin, Elizabeth, who's now sitting on the throne in England. And the movie portrays her, and I don't doubt she might have said something like this. First of all, she never actually met Elizabeth and never got to speak to Elizabeth. Elizabeth wouldn't deign to meet with her. But the movie showed the meeting, just so they could have a conversation. I'm sitting here watching this movie, and I'm real familiar with the history. Have you ever watched a movie and wondered how much of it was true? I just get done studying all this. I'm watching the movie going, that's not right. That's not what happened. Anyhow, she tells Elizabeth, I'm your queen. Oh, gee. And I'm sure she viewed herself that way. In order to strengthen her claim to the English throne, she married her cousin, Henry Stuart, Lord Darnley, who also had a distant claim to the throne. And we'll show this on the, I'll bring up a genealogy here in a minute, that chart that I showed you before, and show you the connection here. Because what Elizabeth told her was, you need to marry an Englishman. And the reason she wanted her to marry an Englishman is they wanted to be able to control Mary, Queen of Scots, through her husband. And so if she marries a good Englishman, then we'll have controls in place. And Mary, Queen of Scots' deal was she wanted to be seen as the successor to Elizabeth when and if she passed on. And she said, you can have that, but you have to marry an Englishman. Well, They sent an Englishman for her to marry, one that they could control. She didn't like that Englishman. She found a Catholic Englishman that she could marry, Darnley. And it's like, that's not what we had in mind. So a lot of game playing going on here. Moray, remember, this is her half illegitimate brother advisor, objected to the marriage and to Mary's agreement with Spain to uproot Protestantism. She was working with Spain. Spain's Catholic also. And when his objections went unheeded, she stopped listening to him. He rebelled. He said, I'm done. You just blew it. Well, then Mary calls on another gentleman, James Hepburn, Lord Bothwell, who was a military leader, and he defeated Moray and forced Moray out of the country. He had to seek refuge in London. And Mary was encouraged by this victory, and she declared she would soon sit on the throne of London. This was just the beginning. I kicked out Moray. I've got my new Catholic husband. I got this military guy who's fighting for me. He showed himself able to overcome Moray and his forces. We're fixing to take over here. Okay, so that was the big chart that I showed you before, and I zoomed in a little bit this time, so maybe we can read it a little bit better. So you have James V of Scotland and Mary of Guise, or the parents of Mary, Queen of Scots, or Mary Tudor. She was originally married to Francis II, who died when she was in France. So she comes back to Scotland, and she marries this Harry Stuart, a Catholic guy, who is also descended from the same line. You see that? They're actually relatives. He's descended through his mom's side to Margaret Tudor, Queen of Scots, who's the grandmother. So she tied herself back into the royal line by marrying somebody who was also in that line. That kind of gives her some extra oomph, as it were, in terms of leadership. Of course, he's the king now. She has to listen to him, which she's not going to like too much. But she figures, you know, it was a means to an end. And they end up having a son, by the way, who's King James, which we'll see later. So having lost Moray's counsel, Mary's policy became increasingly unwise. For a while there, he was kind of keeping her from doing stupid things that would upset the Protestants and get her in trouble. And now she's just kind of like, she's out of control. She's on her own, doing whatever she wants. She decided that she had made a mistake in marrying Darnley. I mean, first of all, she did it against her half-brother's wishes and against a lot of other people's wishes. But then she decided, not happy with the guy. And so she let her feelings be known to Bothwell. That's the military guy who came in and defeated Moray. And she says, you know, I'm not really happy with this husband of mine. And by the way, I kind of like you. Shortly after, Darnley was murdered. And the main suspect was Bothwell. Because once he knocks him out of the way, then he can have Mary for his own wife. She was expressing interest in him. She's not a person of integrity, as you can tell. You can tell why John Knox was not very happy with her for many reasons. Bothwell was legally exonerated in a trial in which no witnesses for the prosecution were allowed. Well, you got to be suspicious of a trial where the prosecution can't bring witnesses. You know, it's like if the other side didn't get to present their case, they just lose the trial, just like out of hand. Almost sounds like some stuff that's going on with trials in our country these days. Anyhow, he was exonerated, but it did little to allay suspicion, particularly since Mary married Bothwell a few months later. It's like, this does not smell good. this stinks. The Scottish lords hated Bothwell, and they soon rebelled. Enough of all this. Enough of Mary, enough of Bothwell, enough of all this nonsense. And when Mary sought to quell the rebellion, she discovered that her troops were not willing to support her cause, and she found herself in the hands of the Lord. Suddenly she realizes she's looking around and nobody's on her side anymore. They're all saying, what do you mean we? She's going, what? They convinced her that they had proof of her participation in Darnley's death, and they gave her the choice of either abdicating or being tried for murder. You pick. Because we have evidence that you're guilty of murder. You and Bothwell here, and we can put you to death, or you can just abdicate and give this thing up. Well, she didn't have much of a choice at that point. So she abdicated in favor of her then one-year-old son, James VI, whom she had with Darnley. And Moray returned from England to serve as regent of Scotland. Remember, he'd been driven out by her whenever Bothwell came along and drove him out of town. So Moray returns. She said, "All right, I abdicate. I give up my, I give over to King James, my son." They take him away from her. She never sees him again, because he now is going to be the rightful king, because he's too young right now to rule. So they bring in a regent. They bring in Moray, and this is how things were done back then. You know, you have royalty. Maybe they're too young to rule, so they're training them up, and then when they get to the right age, they can then step into their role as monarch or what have you. So he was trained up, but not by her. They took him away from her. She was in prison. Mary managed to escape and raise an army in support of her cause, but she was defeated by Moray's troops this time, and her only recourse was to flee to England. Oh, this had to kill her. And seek refuge under her hated cousin, Elizabeth. The only choice she had, it was either, you know, be killed at the hands of the Scots who were fed up with her, or go plead on Elizabeth, say, "Please, I'm your cousin, take me." So she goes to Elizabeth, and it says here, romantic imagination has woven many a tale around Mary's captivity and death, making her a martyr in the hands of the cruel and ambitious cousin, Elizabeth. And the movie in some ways did that, although I think they showed sufficiently that she was what she was, but it was interesting the way it showed their relationship. The truth is that Elizabeth received her with greater courtesy than could be expected for someone who had so long declared her illegitimate in an effort to take possession of her crown. I mean, somebody comes up and says, "You're not even a legitimate queen. I'm a legitimate queen." And you expect to be, you know, welcomed with open arms? Not quite. Anyhow, Elizabeth treated her very well, although she was a prisoner. In a sense, she was not allowed to leave the castle of her residence. There were strict orders she should be treated as a queen, and she was allowed to choose her own body of 30 servants. So she had servants, she had a castle. She couldn't leave, but they treated her like a queen otherwise. And she said, "Yeah, this is the best I'm going to give you, like it or not." But even in prison, Mary was a danger to Elizabeth. One Roman Catholic plot after another was formed to topple Elizabeth and replace her with Mary. The Catholics were convinced that we should not have a Protestant ruler. We want a Catholic ruler. Mary, Queen of Scots, is our lady. Let's topple Elizabeth and Mary will be the new queen. When a plot was exposed in which Mary was implicated in a conspiracy to assassinate Elizabeth, the queen's patience was at an end, understandably. So it was off with her head, as they say. And February 8th, 1857, Mary was beheaded for treason. Well, in Scotland, meantime, after her death, Mary's exile did not put an end to the disputes. There were still a lot of warring parties going on. And eventually, the King's Party, led by the Earl of Morton, triumphed in civil war. And from then on, until 1580, Morton ruled Scotland with a strong hand. Peace and Protestantism were secure under his government. He was a Protestant leader, and he managed to get things kind of consolidated and bring things back to order, and Protestantism was secure again. Knox, in the meantime, had become a very sick man. He suffered a stroke, and he was paralyzed. He was no longer able to preach, and he no longer had the power that he once had to dazzle the nation with his fiery sermons and whatnot. So he was taken off the scene. He died November 24, 1572, and was buried in the churchyard of St. Giles Kirk. Kirk is a word for church, as you might know. In fact, that's probably where we get our word church. Kirk, church. Morton's epitaph, spoken at the funeral, was fitting. Here's what he said about Knox. "There lies one who neither feared nor flattered any flesh." That's a good summary of John Knox. He was a fearless man. He stood for what he stood for. He fought to the bitter end, and he fought a good fight. If you go over today to look at his grave, you will find it's been paved over in a parking lot, and all you have is one of the parking spots in the parking lot has a little plaque that labels it was somewhere around here John Knox was buried. They end up just paving a parking lot over the graveyard and over his grave, and Scotland has long since moved on and forgotten their great leader. Mary's son James, in the meantime, was anointed King of the Scots at the age of 13 months on July 29, 1567. Again, anointed king and actually serving in that role are two different things. And there was a sermon given at the coronation that was preached at the time by John Knox. James was put under the tutelage of George Buchanan, a Scottish writer and educator who instilled in him a lifelong passion for literature and learning and sought to turn James into a God-fearing Protestant king who accepted the limitations of the monarchy. Interesting arrangement here. You've got a guy who's a Scottish Protestant, and these Protestants were very big believers in, there were limits on authority. There were limits on the king. And so he's raising the king to be someday, and he's teaching them every day. Kings are limited in their authority. Kings can't just do whatever they want, you know, and he's teaching them the Bible, and he's teaching them Protestantism. He's training them up. He has a chance to train up a king who will later serve Protestantism well. Unlike his mother. Upon Queen Elizabeth's death in 1603, Queen Elizabeth eventually dies, he becomes the King of England, James I of England, Scotland, and Ireland. He was James VI in Scotland and James I in England, if that makes sense. Because remember, there were a line of James already in Scotland. So, and that's the King James. You know, your King James Bible was written under his reign. This is the King James, the son of Mary, Queen of Scots, and her Catholic husband. The triumph of Protestantism in Scotland through the Reformation Parliament had profound impact both on Scottish identity and on Anglo-Scottish relationships. And I talked about this last week a little bit. Traditionally, England had been the old enemy of Scotland since the 13th century, and the Scots had in some senses defined themselves as those who existed in this context of hostility with the English. The Reformation changed all that. So the Scots and the English were constantly battling for centuries. And the one thing that brought the two countries together was Protestantism. The victory of the Protestant faith over Roman Catholicism, both in England and Scotland, and with English help in Scotland, forged a new psychological bond between the two nations. Not surprisingly then, Protestant Scotland became a pro-English country, and this helped pave the way for the union between their monarchies in 1603, that was King James, of course, and eventually their parliaments in 1707. So the two nations were actually brought together by the Protestant Reformation and how it played out in these two countries, the way we watched it unfold this morning with Mary, Queen of Scots, and all the drama that went on there. So that's that, and the next time we get back into our history, we're going to look at the Catholic Counter-Reformation. So the Catholics have been, you know, being knocked out left and right by Reformation here, Reformation there. We had, you know, starting with Luther, and then we had Zwingli, and we had Calvin, and now we've got, you know, all that went on in England with Henry VIII and all the guys there, and in Scotland, all that we've been seeing. And at one point, the Catholics began to really strike back. They said, enough of this Reformation business, you know. And so they had a counter-Reformation in an attempt to reverse the tide. They weren't successful, but they made a big effort. And this here is a picture of something we're eventually going to get to called the Council of Trent, where they got together and defined their doctrines and took a strong stance. They dug in their heels and doubled down against the Protestants. And so we'll see all that. I'm thinking, though, that next week, because it's the closest week to Christmas, I'll probably do some kind of a Christmas special like I do. I'm still thinking about what I want to do. possibly thinking about the idea. A lot of the Christmas traditions that we celebrate were actually developed during the Tudor years. Because I was thinking about looking at historical Christianity. I'm still playing with it. We'll see what we come up with, but maybe something like that. So next week will be a Christmas week, and then we'll get back to the Counter-Reformation. All right, class discussion time. John Knox showed great courage and conviction that did much to shape the history of Scotland in his day for good. Knox not only took a strong theological stance, but involved himself in the politics of his day, where he preached and applied his theology to politics as well as the church. Do you see room for this kind of role on the part of preachers and theologians in our present day, explained. Because there are some preachers in our day who feel like they should never, they should barely touch politics, if ever touch it. Not everyone. I mean, there's different mixes of thoughts there, but John Knox would clearly tell you very much people, when they speak in church, application can be made in the political realm. You think he's right. Despite John Knox's positive influence in the history of Scotland, he seems to have lost much of his luster in the eyes of modern Scots who built a parking lot over his gravesite. Is this perhaps a good reminder to us that what matters in history is not always how succeeding generations view us, but ultimately how God views us? Kind of a rhetorical question, but just something to think about there. Because I find that a little bit depressing that they think no more than John Knox than what they did. And of course, you can always bring up your own question as well. So that's what I come up with today for questions, and I turn it over to you to interact a little bit on all this. Yes?
Oh, fill in the gaps.
Okay.
Of was she in exile under Queen of England for those whole 20 years?
Yeah. Yeah, she was locked in her castle. She couldn't do nothing but enjoy her servants.
Because there's a 20-year gap, right?
Yeah, I know. It was Elizabeth put up with her for a long, long time.
Okay. And then James, I mean, incredibly important who tutors your child.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm surprised I haven't heard of George Buchanan. But so he was one, and he didn't become king until 37. He wasn't tutored for 36 years after he became an adult.
Yeah.
What did he do? Did he have any positions or anything, or was he just does your history thing say? 36
yeah,
years is a long time.
I'm still hoping to get back to him at some point and maybe talk about what he did. I just wanted to kind of show you how he got into position.
Oh, okay.
And so I wasn't really trying to develop him very much. I know he, well, there's a lot that goes on with him, and I hope we'll get to cover that. I think the Puritans had their issues with King James, but...
I just think of him, oh, okay, he was tutored, and he then went, you know, like Josiah, when he became 12 or 14 or whatever, he became king. But no, he was way a grown man before he, so I just was curious what he did.
Yeah, it took a while.
You know? King of Scotland, and then when Elizabeth died, he became king of Scotland and of England. So he's king of Scotland.
And it just didn't say when he became a queen.
Yeah.
Was he technically king when he was one?
Yeah,
surprisingly, I was really trying to find more details myself on him, and my history books were remarkably silent on him, which was disappointing to me. I actually had to go outside of the history books. You'll notice some of the footnotes were internet links to Wikipedia and stuff like that, just to try to fill in the gaps.
Is this happening contemporary to what was happening in Germany with Martin Luther?
What's that?
Is this happening contemporary to Martin Luther at the same time?
Well... Luther, of course, you know, the 99 Theses are 1517, so this is probably a little bit further down the road, but there's still things going on with Luther at this time.
Okay.
That's one of the things I keep reminding the class from time to time, is that I'm kind of going back through and looking at a thread of history, and then there's overlap between my threads. As I present it to you, it seems sequential, but it's really not. It's like, while this was happening over here, this was happening over here, and this was happening over here. Yeah, so there's a little bit of overlap going on because there's some influence of Luther in some of the early stuff, especially what we looked at last week in Scotland. We got young students coming back from school in Germany going, hey, this Reformation stuff's pretty cool, you know, and they're being an influence along with John Knox in Scotland. So, yeah, there was some simultaneousness going on there. Though, again, Luther has been in place a lot longer. So, other thoughts?
I've struggled with point one quite a bit.
A lot of people
do. You mentioned how John Knox exposited the passage, and then he did a fiery sermon on its modern applications. I think there, I mean, that's what any good sermon needs to do, is to bridge the burden of the passage to a modern audience, for sure. But where I struggle is just an understanding. Jesus says, my kingdom is not of this world. Yeah, pay taxes to Caesar, but my kingdom is not as of this world. Here's a Sermon on the Mount to explain to you how my kingdom works and make priority out of that. At the same time, I mean, we are in a context that is the world. So how do we operate as citizens of a kingdom while here, and to whatever degree we can influence the here, I think we should. But the question is how the role of preachers in that process. And I've struggled.
We're obviously encouraged to be an influence through prayer. I think it's, was it 1 Timothy? It talks about pray for your rulers. A lot of people take pray for your rulers mean like pray for their salvation. Well, maybe, but it really in the context says that it may go well with you. You may live a quiet life.
Yes.
That your rulers will not be trouble for you. So there's an interest in Paul's writing to for the ruler not to be trouble. Now, you know, the ability that Christians had to participate in a political process at the time Paul wrote versus by the time Scotland comes, you know, comes along, things have changed where Christians are actually able to be a part of the political process. And that's where it gets a little bit tricky because that wasn't the context in the New Testament.
Right. I see the same problem in our country with history as far as waning. You know, the things that were learned in the past are not appreciated in the, right now, you know. Especially with all the monuments being torn down.
Yeah.
And, you know, although, but how does God view that, you know, in our country?
Mm-hmm.
You know. But I, you know, the same people that were alive in 1900 aren't alive today. You know, that's only 100 years.
Yeah.
So we don't have the same knowledge base, I guess you would say, to say, well, this is what happened, you know, at this time, for any kind of religious effort.
Yeah, something that might have been really significant back in 1900 looks different today.
Yeah.
People don't have the knowledge of it. People forget. Mm-hmm. Those things get distorted.
Right.
You know, even the goofy movie I watched, even though they got a lot of the history right, there were a lot of details they really got correct.
But they always
added
stuff.
But they introduced all this garbage perversion.
Yeah.
It infuriated me that they did that, because it was a good movie otherwise. It was well made, you know.
Mm-hmm. What you were saying about the confusion about how much to be involved, my thought was it just depends on how you interpret the meaning of be salt.
So,
I mean, somebody can apply that totally different.
So somebody interpret what?
The idea of being salt, how would you apply being salt?
Right, right, salt and light idea.
And you can really be real salty, or you can...
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I do know that, you know, the spectrum of to what degree are we talking about? Are we going to start putting political signs in the yard? Are we going to endorse candidates? Are we going to bash the other candidate and get involved in the mudslinging and you know, versus there is a line where, as relates to abortion, we're going to preach sermons against abortion, and we're going to include that as often as we can as we preach against what the culture is doing. But then on some of those more gray area zones, even social justice to some degree, there's a... What do we, how do we speak into that, like the refugee matter, the refugees, a big political element to it. It wasn't just, hey, let's take care of widows and orphans and those who are displaced. Of course, as Christians, we should do that. But there's this political layer that there's more to it than just the issue. And so, I would want to preach that the church's responsibility should be by default to take care of those who are at our borders needing assistance. But there's so much, there's like a bigger agenda that needs discussion, and should our sermons warrant the explanation of those things? Or should our sermons primarily be an exposition of the text and preach the text, not preach what's happening at the border, if that makes sense?
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously, you start with the text. That's kind of what John Knox, I guess, was good at, you know, is you start with the text. But then the question becomes, how does the text apply?
Yeah.
That's the question you're asking. And I think that question needs to be asked, and not just in politics, it needs to be asked in everyday life, too. You know, your life may not have the specifics going on that the text is addressing, but there are principles in the text that would have application in your life, whether it be your marriage or your family or your government or whatever. And yeah, that's where it takes wisdom. You know, it's one thing to take care of orphans and widows, another thing to allow people to overrun your borders where you don't have borders. You know, there are other issues come into play, you know, and you get thinking about the nations and, yeah, you know, government and what they're supposed, what their role
the
is.
The role of the church versus the role of government.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it becomes complicated.
To teach us discernment. So if there's all these lies being put forth in the world, then the church would be helpful for the church to teach its sheep the difference between the, you know, instead of just saying here's the Bible, but not teach us how it relates to what's biblical and what's not biblical about the what's going on in the political system.
Well, I agree. The church preachers should address the culture. I guess the big question is, what is that going to look like in a sermon?
Yeah. All right, guys. Well, we're out of time. Let us close in prayer. Father, we just thank you for this opportunity. These issues remain hot issues in our own day and worthy of our thought, worthy of our consideration. Give us wisdom as we try to apply these things in our day. Pray in Christ's name. Amen. You're dismissed.